B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, October 1st, 2018. The new government fiscal year begins without a federal shutdown. How about that? But the controversy continues to swirl in Washington and across the country regarding the stalled nomination to the Supreme Court of one Brett Kavanaugh. And the big question we approach here on this Monday, following the dramatic events at the Judiciary Committee on Friday, is can we trust this time-limited FBI investigation into some of the allegations of misconduct against Brett Kavanaugh? And I'm skeptical. As you know, I'm a longtime critic of the rogue agency called the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It goes back to J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, and in my view, there's quite a bit of consistency in the unreliability of the FBI. And they've been given a very difficult assignment and a very limited time frame. And it's even a little confusing. Friday night, I was watching an interview with Senator Cory Booker, the New Jersey Democrat who sits on the Judiciary Committee, and he did not know the scope of the investigation. In particular, will the third accuser, Julie Swetnick, represented by attorney Michael Avenatti, be interviewed by the FBI? As of this morning, Avenatti says there has been no attempt to contact her. And Trump made it even more confusing. We'll talk a little bit later about the details of the new trade agreement that he says will replace NAFTA. Congress has to approve it, of course. But at the news conference that was focused on the trade deal, there were questions, and Trump tried to dodge them at first, and then he did answer some questions about Kavanaugh. And he made things more confusing. Now, he said he is open to a very comprehensive investigation, but he doesn't say that that's what he ordered. And he said the scope of this will be guided by the wishes of Republican senators. The Democrats, of course, have brought this as a smear job and a con game, and so they don't get to be involved. And this is where Trump makes serious partisan errors. Because the investigation, circumscribed as it probably is going to go forward. And to squeeze the Democrats out of it leaves this with a partisan aftertaste, no matter what the outcome happens to be. So here's a quote from the Trumpster. I want them to do a very comprehensive investigation, whatever that means, according to the senators and the Republicans and the Republican majority. I'm guided by the Senate. I want to make the Senate happy. Yeah. Now, Senate Democrats on the Judiciary Committee submitted a list of more than two dozen people that they'd like to see interviewed, but they are, as Trump has described here, just in the spectator stand for this particular part of the event. Now, Trump did make a couple of comments that aren't particularly helpful to his nominee. He seemed to undercut Kavanaugh, saying that Kavanaugh had acknowledged he had, quote, difficulty, end quote, with alcohol. I watched him, Trump said. I was surprised at how vocal he was about the fact that he likes beer. Now, one thing about Trump, he claims that he doesn't drink, and I've never seen any evidence to the contrary. He does hoist a glass in formal toasts at times, but I've never seen alcohol cross his lips, not that I've watched that carefully. He did have a brother who was an alcoholic, and he said that is one of the reasons that he doesn't drink. So to hear this teetotaler talk about that, and a little later he said, I really believe he was very strong on the fact that he drank a lot. Now, that was Trump's interpretation of the dodging that Kavanaugh did when he was pressed about his drinking. Did he ever black out, asked Senator Klobuchar, and he answered that by asking her if she had ever blacked out. That's not really being, quote, very strong on the fact that he drank a lot. He has tried to minimize it, to dodge it, and I think that that could be the perjury trap that ultimately could cause his nomination to crater. I don't have high confidence in that, but that would be the route if that does occur. Now, the other big development is that Senator Tom Cotton and who else? There's another Republican senator who made a call for an investigation of Dianne Feinstein. I think it was Lindsey Graham. That's who it was. And Trump told the news conference that Feinstein probably leaked the letter from Dr. Blasey Ford to the public. She very repeatedly and strongly has denied that. But this is a Republican talking point that furthers their idea that this was a trap that was sprung at the last minute to derail this confirmation process. So the critical issue is whether Julie Swetnick is part of this reinvestigation of Kavanaugh. And she's the one with the substantial claims and somewhat tawdry claims that she was at parties where girls were gang raped and that Kavanaugh was either a participant or a witness. And Trump said he wouldn't be bothered at all if the FBI interviews Swetnick. Now, not being bothered by it is not the same as issuing the instructions to the FBI to talk to her. And this kind of language, loose language, slippery language, is part of the whole Republican rhetorical assault here. I heard Limbaugh this morning echoing Kavanaugh, converting people who say they have no recollection, converting that testimony or those comments into they say it never happened. That is flatly untrue. So the kind of exaggeration and rewriting of some of the testimony here is something we have to be very vigilant about in this critical period before they attempt to send the Kavanaugh nomination to the Senate floor for a final vote. So we're going to have to watch carefully and see who actually does get contacted by the FBI. We don't know where their testimony, where the FBI 302 reports will be sent, because the Judiciary Committee is finished with its business related to Kavanaugh. Do the reports go to both party leaders for distribution to all senators? Do they go to the White House where they will be edited, filtered, rewritten? We don't know. And this is a really troubling part of this moment where they're trying to create the illusion that, yeah, we're going to really examine Brett Kavanaugh, but their intention is to come up with no new information so they can ram his confirmation through the full Senate. And today, the Republicans released a report from Rachel Mitchell. She was the grandmother type sex crimes prosecutor they brought in from Phoenix to question Christine Blasey Ford last Thursday. Well, the summation of her report, and I think I have another detail on it coming up, but she said, I do not think that a reasonable prosecutor would bring this case based on the evidence before the committee, nor do I believe that this evidence is sufficient to satisfy the preponderance of evidence standard. But she's applying standards from criminal cases that do not apply in the confirmation process of a Supreme Court justice. And that is intentional. The Republicans want to turn this into a criminal process where there isn't enough proof to convict Brett Kavanaugh. But it is nothing of the sort. And this is, to me, a critical bottom line of the whole Republican posture here. And that is that this is one of the rare moments where they ever advocate for the rights of the accused, the presumption of innocence, the rule of evidence. Consider just how anomalous, how unusual, how out of character this is for Republicans. And it is selective and opportunist on their parts. Now, Jeff Flake appeared on 60 Minutes last night with his good buddy, the Democrat from Delaware, Chris Coons, and they were just bromancing all over the place. And Coons puts aside so much of what is you know, critically bad about Brett Kavanaugh, to embrace a kind of bipartisanship, and that his friend, the Republican from Arizona, had this moment of conscience on Friday and, you know, put a stipulation onto his vote to support Brett Kavanaugh. But he voted for Kavanaugh. He didn't vote present. He didn't delay the committee vote until there's a full investigation. And so I believe his heroism is a 2 on a 10 scale. And when Flake told Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes last night that he believes both Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford, I'm sorry, it's just another moment where you have to say, this guy is a mess. Yes, he has moments of moral standards and tries to express them, but the bottom line is he's a movement conservative and a dedicated Republican. And he acknowledges that it was those two young women, victims of sexual assault, who harangued him in the Senate elevator on Friday that pressed his buttons. And he set a red line on 60 Minutes last night. He said if this FBI investigation shows that Brett Kavanaugh lied under oath, that Flake said the nomination couldn't go forward. He didn't say he'd vote against it. He said it couldn't go forward. And you have to listen carefully to the language these people use. Now comes forward Charles Ludington. He teaches at North Carolina State University. He told the Washington Post he and Kavanaugh were friends at Yale. And he calls Kavanaugh's testimony a blatant mischaracterization of his drinking habits. The Brett he knew, Ludington said, was a frequent and heavy drinker who often became belligerent and aggressive when inebriated. And there's an important allegation that Ludington makes. And that is that in one scene where he drank with Kavanaugh, Kavanaugh got belligerent, he provoked a fight, and the friend that they were drinking with ended up in jail because of the fight he had with Brett Kavanaugh. So these are serious issues that are being raised. Serious conflicts in the testimony that Kavanaugh gave under oath. But the Republicans want to brush it all aside. Boys will be boys. Yeah, he did some drinking, but he you know, and yes, Dr. Ford was assaulted, but not by Kavanaugh. I mean, that is so, as I mentioned on Friday, so condescending and just irrational to say that you can believe both of them. And that she just happened to be mistaken about who it was who assaulted her. So St. James Comey showed up in the New York Times with an op-ed Sunday saying that if truth were the only goal, there would be no time limit on this. The investigation would not have been sought after the committee had already endorsed the nominee. He says, although the process is deeply flawed and apparently designed to thwart the fact-gathering process, the FBI is up for this. Well, thanks, Jim. That's a real confidence builder. Now, he can't say bullshit in the New York Times, so he says agents have much better nonsense detectors than partisans because they aren't starting with a conclusion. He also says that little lies point to bigger lies, and we know, for example, that Kavanaugh lied openly about whether he had watched Blasey Ford's testimony. There are apparently 2 to 3 witnesses that he watched the whole thing, but he told a senator who asked him, nope. Haven't seen it yet. And so what lie will it be that actually is seen as the smoking gun that requires people to say no to Brett Kavanaugh? A little bit more here on Ludington that I have in this next article in my stack. And this is based on FBI agents, former agents, who have serious doubts about whether this process. One said a complete background check investigation will not be possible without the ability to interview classmates and associates and anybody with knowledge of the circumstances in the time frame in question. And we know that Mark Judge worked at a Safeway store, that Christine Blasey Ford says that she visited in Potomac, Maryland shortly after the attack, and she would like them to determine when he worked there so that she can better refine her estimation of when this actually occurred? And here's the quote from Ludington. When Brett got drunk, he was often belligerent and aggressive. On one of the last occasions I purposely socialized with him, I witnessed him respond to a semi-hostile remark, not by defusing the situation, but by throwing his beer in the man's face and starting a fight that ended up with one of our mutual friends in jail. Now, that is a specific event. We don't have the name of the third party who wound up in jail, but I think that could be determined probably pretty quickly by these FBI experts. So we'll see where all that goes. Also, I learned over the weekend from my brother, who's the family historian, that three of my uncles attended Georgetown Prep in the 1930s, maybe the early 1940s, and one of them got kicked out. We think he was the founder of the 100 Keg Club. At any rate, there are alumni of Georgetown Prep who have launched a petition encouraging their fellow alumni to come forward. If you know anything surrounding the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, now is the time to come forward. Whether it's knowledge of specific events in these allegations or just background, please do not remain silent, even if speaking out comes at some personal cost. Well, as someone who was trained at a Jesuit high school, not in Washington, but in Cincinnati, I embrace this call. While I have left the Catholic Church and I don't embrace a lot of what I was taught at that Jesuit school, I do have a strong moral core. And it would require me, if I had a classmate who was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court and I knew what people should know about him, my Jesuit training would require me to step forward. We'll see if the Georgetown Prep alumni operate in the same manner. Now, I mentioned that Jeff Flake set his own red line, and that is that if the investigation proves that Kavanaugh lied, committed perjury last week, that the nomination could not move forward. Well, the New York Times, in the Saturday paper, listed a number of the topics where Brett Kavanaugh either misled senators or, in my view, lied to them. The language here is a little polite and lawyerly. They talk about things that are misleading or disputed. But you come away with a clear understanding that he didn't tell the truth. And I'll just select, I mean, there's excessive drinking, the issue of Renata, who showed up on the yearbook pages of all of the jocks that Kavanaugh hung out with and drank with. There's the issue of the yearbook lingo. And let's just talk about one of those claims. He was asked what Devil's Triangle referred to on his calendar from the summer of 82, and he said it was a drinking game, and nobody challenged that. But if you do an online search for Devil's Triangle, it has nothing to do with drinking. It is a sexual scene involving two males and one female. And I believe that there needs to be further interrogation of Brett Kavanaugh on some of these topics. Not sure there's going to be a forum for that, but it screams for it. Then we have the issue of Kozinski, Alex Kozinski, who was bounced off of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco last year, disgraced by his own use of pornography on the job, the way he approached particularly female interns and clerks with sexist remarks and showing them porn and asking them if it turned them on. Well, this is a serious issue because Kozinski's son was serving last year as a clerk to Brett Kavanaugh. And so Kavanaugh's claims that, gosh, I don't remember getting any of those sordid emails from Kozinski, and, you know, I just can't recall. Well, that's a dodge that is not likely to hold up under closer scrutiny. Now to the report from Rachel Mitchell. The Washington Post assigned a reporter who has a background as a former sex crimes prosecutor in Brooklyn. And let's see what her name is here. She's a new one to me, Deanna Paul. But she gently takes apart the Rachel Mitchell report And one of the issues she raises is what I already said, that this is not a criminal prosecution, and so those comparisons are ridiculous. And she also notes, one of the points I made on Friday, is that Kavanaugh and his allies typically take a claim that I don't remember anything and call that a refutation, a proof that the claims are false. And that's one of the efforts that Rachel Mitchell makes in her new report. One of the best commentaries I read over the weekend, I've linked to in the show file for this podcast. It's by Roger Cohen, opinion writer at the New York Times. What America saw before the Judiciary Committee was an injudicious man, an angry brat veering from fury to sniveling sobs, a judge so bereft of composure and proportion that it was difficult not to squirm. Kavanaugh actually got teary over keeping a calendar because that's what his dad did. It's really well written, and I won't take more time because there's so much else to cover here. But follow the links and check out that commentary, should you so desire. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Julie Dupree, Jim McHugh, DGL, you know who you are, and Joe Clarici. Each of them kick in $5 or $10 a month to support this podcast, and I'm inviting you to do the same. All you have to do is drop in at peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. When you get to the sign-up page, it's easy to choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription earns you the bonus gift, our rock and roll CD by John Dist called American University, and I'd love to send it your way. Well, all of this partisan turmoil suggests the need for a third political party. And today I'm releasing a podcast over at Who, What, Why with my longtime friend, Tom Campbell. And Tom is a Republican. He and I don't agree on every issue. He is a Milton Friedman economist from the Chicago School, and I don't subscribe to those views. But Tom and I have a lot in common because our political parties have abandoned us. I'm a former Democrat. He's a former Republican. And he's come up with an interesting way to start a third party in California. The working title is the Golden Bear Party. But he's open to change on that, and I am soliciting ideas for a name for a third party in California. But he makes a strong case that with the number of independent voters we're called no party preference here in California at 4.9, we have almost as many people who are unaligned as the Republican parties have declared members, 5.2 million. The Democrats have 8 million. Now, what that shows you is that fewer than half of the population in California actually is registered to vote. But when you look at that breakdown, there is room. And here's an excerpt from my conversation with Tom Campbell, where he explains some of the political rules here in California and his effort to get around some of them.
But in reality, the third parties were not surviving anyway. They would have a candidate in November, but the candidate would never win, whether that's Peace and Freedom, Green, or Libertarian. So what it does is to focus on the primary, the top two primary. And I did a substantial amount of polling on the attractiveness of an independent candidate. And if an independent candidate makes it past the primary, she or he is favored overwhelmingly against a Democrat or against a Republican. So the issue is getting past the top two primary into the finals without having to choose one of the two major parties. And if we were able to create a truly independent party, that vehicle would be the way of doing it.
That's former California Congressman and former Republican Tom Campbell. He now teaches law in Southern California, and he, as you heard, wants to start a third political party. I invite your comments and your suggestions for a name. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com. Now, at that news conference about the rewrite of NAFTA, Trump has given it a new name, putting the United States first in the name. He just can't help it. Anyway, he kind of continued his misogynist behavior toward female reporters. And part of it was his irritation that he wanted to talk about trade, and after a few questions about trade, the reporters wanted to talk about Brett Kavanaugh. And so ABC News reporter Cecilia Vega got called on by Trump, and he said, "She's shocked that I picked her. She's in a state of shock." She responded calmly, "I'm not. Thank you, Mr. President." He retorted, "That's okay. I know you're not thinking. You never do." She said, "I'm sorry?" And he said, "No, go ahead, go ahead." And for her second question, she attempted to ask him about the allegations about Brett Kavanaugh. He cut her off. "What does that have to do with trade? I don't mind answering the question, but, you know, I'd like to do the trade questions." He said he would get back to her later, and he actually did. But another female reporter from CNN, where he usually makes fun of them and ignores their questions, says, "Now that you've answered questions on trade, I'd like to turn to Kavanaugh." He said, "Don't do that. Do you have a question on trade? We'll do a couple more questions on trade, okay? Don't do that. And besides, someone is before you. Do you have a question on trade?" he said to another reporter. So when left to his devices, Trump is openly hostile to females. And he doesn't have a clue that it undermines his credibility with people who aren't poisoned by the Trump virus when it comes to the Kavanaugh case. So, the new NAFTA deal is going to be called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, not NAFTA. And I haven't read it all. It runs 1,000 pages, but the news accounts I've seen indicate that there are some improvements, particularly for the auto industry, where there is a base wage throughout the entire region. So Canada, the United States, and Mexico cannot hire auto workers or people to make auto parts for less than $16 an hour. Now, I think that's progress. NAFTA didn't have those kinds of markers. Now, again, I want to get further analysis, and I'll even try to read most of it if I can. But this particular item stands out as an improvement. Now, on the negative side, the Trump administration is maintaining steel tariffs on Mexico and Canada, claiming it's a national security issue, and that's just pure bullshit. But we will see if those get resolved, because this is a process that's been started, and it will require congressional approval, and there will likely be more modifications to this draft agreement. Canada did win a victory, though, by forcing Trump to relent. He wanted to pull out a clause in the NAFTA agreement that allowed for mediation of disputes between the three nations party to this deal. Mexico had agreed to it. But Justin Trudeau dug in his fancy boots, and he won the day, I'm a little surprised to say. The Washington Times, in order to settle a lawsuit brought by the brother of late DNC worker Seth Rich, has acknowledged that they published an article that has been found to be false. It was an op-ed written by Admiral James Lyon, retired, falsely claiming that it was well known in the intelligence circles that Seth Rich and his brother Aaron were paid by WikiLeaks for the DNC emails. And, of course, this is used to shut down any questions that people have about whether Seth Rich was possibly the guy who leaked DNC documents to WikiLeaks. Well, the lawyer for Aaron Rich said in a statement, "The Washington Times' decision to take responsibility, apologize for its role in propagating lies, well, it's a milestone in our case, as well as in the broader effort to shine a light on conspiracy theorists who spread malicious lies for personal and political gain." Well, I haven't done that. I simply raise honest questions. We're told Seth Rich was killed in a botched robbery. Only his watch, his phone, and his wallet were on his body. And I don't believe there's been a serious investigation of his possible connection to the DNC leaks. And I simply consider it a possibility that has not been disproved. Does that make me a conspiracy theorist? Because after all, the official narrative is, once again, a conspiracy theory. Well, Jerry Brown had to meet a deadline of midnight last night to sign or veto a whole stack of bills from the California legislature. And the big one that he signed establishes net neutrality inside the borders of the state of California. Now, because the internet is a national phenomenon, Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow, I called him Jeffrey again. His name is Jefferson. Anyway, you know who I'm talking about. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, says states do not regulate interstate commerce. The federal government does. Once again, the California legislature has enacted an extreme and illegal state law attempting to frustrate federal policy. Well, I believe that we are well within our rights to have our own net neutrality law in California, and I'm glad that Jerry Brown signed it. It immediately drew a lawsuit, and we'll see how it plays out in the courts. But on an issue that I thought was really novel, where the state of California passed a bill that would have allowed taxpayers who faced a cap on their deductions for, say, state income tax, to treat that as a donation to the state of California in order to beat the loss of a tax deduction, which is part of the Trump corporate tax cuts that were rammed through last December. But Governor Moonbeam said the measure started out as a bold idea, but because of adverse changes in the federal tax law, it now confuses an already complicated scheme and could invite intervention by the Internal Revenue Service. Well, so what, Jerry? You just got the Justice Department hammering the net neutrality law that you signed. Why wouldn't you take the same risk with challenging the tax law that the Republicans wrote? A couple of other items. Brown vetoed a law that would have required campus health centers to stock the Plan B abortion pill. He did two great things related to criminal justice. He signed a law that changes the felony murder rule. And this one really matters to me because I have a good friend who spent 23 years at San Quentin because of the felony murder rule. He was involved in a group situation, but he didn't have a gun. He didn't kill anybody. There were two people killed in this event that occurred back in the 1970s. But he actually did twice as much prison time as one of the guys who shot and killed someone that night. And this is the unintended consequence of the felony murder rule that says if you had any participation, you have the same level of guilt as the guy who pulled the trigger. So a great injustice has been changed here in California, and I thank Governor Brown for that. He also signed a bill that will open police misconduct records. There's been way too much secrecy about the history of bad cops, and I'm glad that he is changing that. He did veto a bill to allow safe injection sites for IV drug users here in San Francisco, and that is a disappointment, among others. On Friday, I told you how billionaire Tesla founder Elon Musk was facing pretty heavy penalties from the Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, they turned around and settled it faster than a Tesla gets up to 60 miles an hour. And Elon Musk is going to pay $20 million out of his own funds and $20 million out of Tesla funds over the single tweet that he sent claiming that he was going to take the company private and he had lined up financing to do it. Caused the stock to surge briefly. And I think the SEC was correct to crack down on Elon Musk. He will be required to resign as chairman and hire an outside chairman of Tesla. And finally, today we say farewell to one of the co-founders of San Francisco's Jefferson Airplane. Marty Ballin passed away at the age of 76. And I got to know Marty a little bit, interviewed him a number of times. He had a great voice. He was the kind of mellow, quiet guy in the airplane and Starship lineup. And he certainly will be missed. I have linked to two great songs that feature Marty Ballin. They're in the show file for today's podcast, and feel free to click over to YouTube to listen to them. One is from the very first Jefferson Airplane album, Surrealistic Pillow. It's called Coming Back to Me. And the other is from a later album by Jefferson Starship, and it's called St. Charles. I hope you'll load them up and play them. Think of Marty Ballin and his beautiful voice and his great work and talent. Thanks for listening to this Daily News and Comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.